Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kurupko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the UK banning the term fake news in official documents. The motivation behind this move is that the government thinks that the word is too broad and is urging people to employ more specific phrases such as disinformation and misinformation instead. This isn't just due to some bureaucrats' personal preferences, however, but because the state plans to more effectively wage information warfare and defend itself from the same. Which is why it needs to be as precise as possible when it comes to tackling these tasks. The two suggested replacement terms practically mean the same thing, though with the important difference being that disinformation is deliberately false, while misinformation is unintentionally so, but both work to sow discord and division in societies, and are much more easily weaponizable in today's interconnected age. One of the most important functions of any intelligence agency is to determine the intent of their targets or whoever pops up on their radar, whether they're an internal actor or an external one. In the context of fighting fake news, the UK is trying to improve the operational efficiency of its analysts by forcing them to discern between disinformation and misinformation instead of just lumping together whatever politically relevant narratives that they come across as fake news for convenience's sake. There is a big difference between a fabricated news story, an analysis that deceives its intended audience through the omission of key facts, and a poorly written op-ed that inadvertently confuses people more than it conveys whatever it is that the author wants to opine about. The most troubling aspect about all of this, however, is that the British government could abuse this new stance to censor free speech on social media. The Telegraph reported that the Digital, Culture, Media, and Sports Committee, whose inquiry prompted this policy, wrote in its interim report earlier this summer that, with such a shared definition and clear guidelines for companies, organizations, and the government to follow, there will be a shared consistency of meaning across the platforms, which can be used as the basis of regulation and enforcement. This makes it obvious that the government is indeed preparing to crack down and regulate disinformation and misinformation, which might even lead to shutting down accounts that criticize Prime Minister May's Brexit strategy if they're determined to have met that subjective criterion. After all, the difference between disinformation and misinformation is largely intent, and determining that in the highly charged political context of Brexit will probably come down to the overseer's opinion. The next one up is India taking advantage of the US-Chinese trade war. The Times of India reported that New Delhi sees a valuable opportunity for its companies to profit during the current global trade tensions between those two economic superpowers, prudently drawing up a list of which niches it could fill in both of them due to their newly imposed tariffs against the other. This is pretty much the economic manifestation of India's policy of so-called multi-alignment, which in this instance is much less controversial than its political and military dimensions because it's difficult to interpret this as being at the expense of one or another player. Simply put, India intends to opportunistically exploit the situation to its advantage, which is its sovereign right. And it might even make progress on reaching its desired free trade agreement with the US throughout the course of this campaign. The US is extremely unlikely to ever return back to its old order of business with China, even in the event that the two reach a major trade deal with one another to end the tariff war, because America doesn't ever want its rival to have the same level of economic influence over it as it did in the past. The solution that some strategists have proposed is for the US to diversify its trade ties with other Asian countries in order to balance out its relationship with China, which is in essence what the former Trans-Pacific Partnership was supposed to be all about. Trump derailed that specific proposal right after entering office, but he nevertheless continued to expand the US's economic ties with its Asian partners on a bilateral basis instead. India was never party to the TPP talks, but is nowadays increasingly emerging as the US's desired long-term counterweight to China. there's close to no chance that the South Asian BRICS member could replace its East Asian counterpart when it comes to America's grand economic strategy. But what it can do is function as a low-wage labor destination for American companies to eventually re-outsource their Chinese-based companies too, if their government gives them low tax or tariff incentives per a future free trade deal with India. The formerly Chinese-occupied niches that India is already planning to fill in the U.S. marketplace could be a realistic starting point for beginning their free trade talks and deciding which fears should be immediately prioritized. Having said that, there's always the chance that the talks fall through for a variety of reasons, but mostly those related to the sensitivities of India's balancing act with Russia and Iran. The U.S. is very uncomfortable with New Delhi's decision to purchase S-400 and continue importing Iranian resources. So there's always a possibility that something goes wrong in their trade negotiations because of it, and these grand economic plans are derailed. Although it appears at this moment to be unlikely, that scenario could lead to India moving closer to China and making progress on the Beijing-proposed Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, by building off of the formerly American-occupied niches that it intends to fill. As a result of its economic multi-alignment, India is now an even more intense object of competition between the U.S. and China than ever before. Third on our countdown, we have China challenging the U.S. in Central America. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in the region late last week when he criticized China's rising influence there by questioning the intentions behind its investment activity, which prompted the country's media to angrily respond earlier this week and lambast the U.S. for trying to drive a wedge into Sino-Latin American relations. Washington is worried that Central America is slipping out of its hegemonic control after tiny El Salvador broke ties with Taiwan in August and recognized Beijing as China's legitimate government in exchange for economic support, which some observers fear could catalyze a chain reaction in this part of the world where the self-proclaimed country counts a handful of its dwindling supporters. From the U.S.'s perspective, China's rising economic influence is clearly having political consequences that might one day manifest themselves in these countries gradually turning away from Washington, like a few of them have already done with Taipei, which could lead to the U.S. losing its unipolar control over the region that it condescendingly regards as its backyard. Even Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez hinted at what he called the opportunity that China's growing diplomatic role in the region could provide, despite he himself having remained in power up until now after winning a disputed election late last year that was controversially endorsed by the U.S. Speaking of opportunities, a new one has suddenly materialized after Trump threatened to curtail the aid that his government was giving to the three Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador as part of the so-called Alliance for Prosperity after they failed to stop thousands of their citizens from participating in the latest caravan crisis, which provides the perfect pretext for China to economically intervene in their support on the condition that the remaining two follow San Salvador's lead and switch the recognition from Taipei to Beijing. This potential pivot could give China indirect control over the U.S.'s border security by making it responsible for stability in those countries after replacing American aid there. It's already recognized that many of these migrants are motivated to flee their homelands by powerful push factors such as systemic mismanagement, corruption, drugs, unemployment, and gang violence, which were what the U.S.'s Alliance for Prosperity Assistance was supposed to address. But it might be China that ends up doing so if Trump curtails these programs like he's planning and Beijing steps in to replace it. Just as disturbing of a scenario for the U.S. is if this has a knock-on effect that enhances Chinese influence in Mexico after its leftist president-elect AMLO takes office at the beginning of December, thereby representing an unprecedented challenge to the U.S.'s political dominance in the entire Western Hemisphere. The catch-22 that the U.S. finds itself in is that its reactionary hybrid war response could just make the migrant crisis even worse. So it's unclear what America can or will do to retain its hegemony there. Our runner-up is Germany suspending arms exports to Saudi Arabia after Khashoggi's killing. Merkel said that her country won't fulfill its contractual commitment to provide the Saudis with hundreds of millions of dollars of arms this year, until Riyadh responsibly answers all the questions pertaining to Khashoggi's killing, which she even termed a monstrosity, and promised that she'll pressure her other EU allies to follow suit. For as disturbing as a dissident's death may be for many, it's nevertheless an internal affair of the Saudi state, despite having taken place abroad, because it occurred in the sovereign territory of the country's consulate and only involved its own citizens. Furthermore, the sale of conventional arms of the kingdom has nothing to do with this journalist's killing, and appears to be nothing more than a convenient means of pressuring Saudi Arabia into complying with the EU leaders' envisioned political steps for dealing with this public relations crisis. It's incredibly ironic that Germany is using weapon sales as an incentive for the stereotypically opaque Saudis to undertake a transparent investigation into Khashoggi's killing, despite the very high likelihood that these same arms could be used for killing many more people throughout the course of the Saudi-led war on Yemen if Merkel is satisfied with the investigation's findings and lifts her mandated suspension. That's not to judge Germany or any other country for advancing their interests through military diplomacy, but just to point out how hypocritical it is that the EU still insists on exporting its so-called values when it clearly compromises on them all the time in pursuit of real politics. Speaking of which, two can play at that game too, and the Saudis almost assuredly no longer have faith in the reliability of their so-called Western partners in the EU after this latest development. Accordingly, it makes sense that Saudi Arabia would strengthen its ties with Russia in response to Germany's instrumentalization of weapon shipments for political purposes, as Moscow doesn't ever place such conditions on any of its partners, and is therefore much easier to conduct business with than Berlin. Far from being incentivized to submit to a foreign country's envisioned political solution to Khashoggi's killing and the potential regime change implications that it could have in Riyadh if Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is convicted in the court of European public opinion for this crime, Saudi Arabia is actually more encouraged than ever before to continue with the diversification of its erstwhile strategic dependency on the West by embracing the likes of Russia and even China in response to the EU's pressure. As a result, Saudi Arabia might eventually become a more responsible player in the emerging multipolar world order. At our top spot, we've got the accusations that the buddies of Brazilian frontrunner Bolsonaro are illegally funding an election meddling campaign on social media. According to reports, Bolsonaro was aware that some of his biggest backers were paying millions of dollars to conduct a far-reaching influence campaign before the second round of the polls this weekend, which would be illegal under Brazilian law because their contributions in support of his campaign weren't publicly acknowledged. He claims to have had no idea that this was going on, and the government pledged to investigate, but critics believe that the state will just cover up for him, and that it doesn't even have enough time to conduct a thorough and transparent investigation into this alleged crime anyhow. The reason why this is so important is because Bolsonaro is leading by a double-digit margin and looks ready to trounce Workers' Party candidate Haddad this Sunday, with a lot of his support being attributed to the active efforts of his social media advocates, who, it's now being alleged, might have actually been paid for their work and or could have just been automated bots. In fact, WhatsApp quietly closed over 100,000 accounts, while its parent company Facebook recently did the same with dozens of high-profile others. But that might be inconsequential in terms of altering the overall infowar dynamics on their platform. In addition, given big tech's bias against right-wing and conservative accounts in the US and Europe, it can't be discounted that some legitimate ones were also blocked in Brazil, though that's not to absolve the Bolsonaro campaign of any alleged illegal activity that it might have been engaged in. Moreover, even in the event that they're guilty as charged, this is unlikely to change the voters' minds, since most of them appear to have already made theirs up by now after the incessant hybrid war on Brazil pushed many of them to take this candidate's side more so than any others. If his supporters still back him, despite the claims that he's a racist, fascist, misogynist, xenophobic, white supremacist, military puppet, then adding the comparatively less offensive label of illegal propagandist to that list probably won't make much of a difference and might even be twisted around by his campaign as proof that Trump's liberal globalist enemies are now targeting the so-called Tropical Trump as a proxy war against the leader who Bolsonaro's praised on numerous occasions. Whatever ends up happening during this Sunday second round of voting, it's undeniable that social media played a disproportionate role in shaping the voters' perceptions, whether legally or not. All right, folks, so this wraps up this week's edition of Contact Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice rest of your week and tune in again next week. Thanks. Bye.